Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Oh my goodness. This is Thanksgiving week here in the United States, and it's just a delight to be able to share this time with you and also with my guest. Her name is Arwinder Kaur, and she's written a book, Living While Human. And her book is quite an interesting read because of her family's history and also because of the professional environment that she found herself evolving into as an adult and how it has made her aware of the various environments she was exposed to here in the United States, and not in the United States, in Canada. In fact, we're going to Vancouver, Canada to talk with her. And this all is quite a fascinating level of insight that you're given into not just a time frame, but how cultures can often evolve patternings that can create so much chaos and so much more. So we're going to be talking about Living While Human. And Arwinder, I want to thank you so much for being my guest. This is an absolute delight, and I thoroughly enjoyed your publication because I honestly didn't know what I was going to find in it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
You make a statement about your book. You say traveling the world in your youth was the best education you could have received. And boy, that is the truth. Your family, your parents, very interesting people. Your dad was a very well-educated individual. Your mother was someone that yearned to be removed from her culture. What culture was it that both of them came from?
Well, my parents started off in their relationship, really. It was a very traditional Indian arranged marriage. And there was about 15 years difference between the two of them. And they came from very different backgrounds in India. My father had actually been raised in more of an agricultural, a village sort of setting, and my mother was actually educated and came from the city, and she had dreams of being very independent and wanted to go sort of, you know, become an artist, a dancer, be into music and acting. And my father was in a very traditional lifestyle of, he had gone into more of a religious studies. And so he was mainly involved in being a Sikh priest. So they came from very, very different backgrounds, and I think that was quite a challenge for them to be able to come together and have, you know, a successful relationship and face all the challenges that they ended up having to face immigrating to, you know, Canada and raising children here.
Mm-hmm. In your mother's culture, girls really didn't have any rights, and they often were married very, very young. In fact, and please correct me if I have any of this information incorrect, but often they were betrothed even when they were babies. I mean, this, yeah. I don't know how strong that is today, but in this mm-hmm. culture, the women, they were, you know, in caste systems. I mean, there was all of this yeah. that had to be contended with. She didn't have any rights.
Well, I mean, traditionally that is very, very true. You know, particularly in during the time that, you know, my parents were younger, things were very, very different for men and for women, but particularly for women. They didn't really have, there was no focus on giving them an education because they weren't expected to have a job outside the home. They would be looking after the husband, the children, and also the in-laws, because the woman traditionally would marry the man and move in with his family. And so those were the traditional roles that she would have to fulfill. And people didn't have a whole lot of choice. You know, there was no no such thing as really personal freedoms. Everything had to do with being part of a family network and what the expectations were by, you know, the elders in the home. So, yeah, I mean, I think early on in those early years, many times people thought that was quite a burden of you know, finding someone for their son or their you know, daughter to marry. And so it was this, like, huge task, and they would like to kind of get it, you know, resolved as soon as possible. So sometimes people that were, you know, from a certain village or lived, you know, in proximity would say, yes, okay, you both have children around the same time, just get that done. You know, make that commitment now so you don't have to worry about it and try and make sure, you know, all of this sort of happens. So, yeah, it did happen early on. But over time, I mean, nowadays, I would say people have a lot more input into who they marry, even in India and certainly here in Canada and in the U.S. Mm-hmm. By and large, people do have more participation in choosing. And in many cases, people do choose their own mates. Mm-hmm. So it has changed quite a bit.
Well, that's good to hear, because I think that has a lot to do with education. I think when men are educated and the women are educated, they do not want someone dictating to them what they have to do. But this isn't unusual in the Indian culture, in the Chinese culture, the Asian culture. So often that is what is expected. You know, someone's going to tell you, gee, this is who you're going to marry, and it doesn't make any difference whether you're compatible or not. It's just sometimes it was political, not unlike the European marriages that were done, you know, mm-hmm. with royalty.
Liaisons. Yeah, it was a coming together of different, alliances, if you will, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be political or royal or whatever. So in some ways, those were traditional kinds of connections that would be made. But, I mean, I think, like any systems, there are pros and cons to both. In Western, so-called Western civilizations, we tend to focus more on individuality and individual's needs, which, you know, is something I talk about a lot in my book. In other cultures, there's more of a focus on a larger network, whether it's your family, extended family, or in the tribe, it might be, you know, members of your tribe and in your kinship. So there's lots of things that are of value in both systems. But really, when you think about it, most of us don't live as completely isolated individuals. So if we're going to live in a society, live within a community, being completely individualistic probably isn't going to be all that helpful in terms of living within a community where people really should be coming together and being there for each other and helping one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that is something that I think of COVID. I think that brought that point home because people were so isolated. And it's taken a while for them to come out of that isolation because of the fears that were promoted at that time.
Has.
Yeah, so
I think it's... Yeah, I think that many people have suffered with those breakdowns of our social connections and our ability to be able to be more social and get together and be with people. And I think when it's your choice, it's one thing. But when you don't have a choice and it's imposed on you, I think there's a certain impact that has had on many people that has been quite negative in terms of how it's impacted their mental health.
Now, when you all landed in Canada, you left India, your dad was given a positioning in the Sikh community. So when you left India, you had a community that the family was able to come into, but your mom never did feel like she wanted to be in that community. Your mother really, really yearned, I think, to be that self-sufficient, independent woman. She had wanted that from the time she was a young person. And here she was married, she had children, and she's dealing with an environment that's foreign to her. But actually, even though it was difficult for your mom, she adapted far better than your dad did.
Well, she embraced it. because this is also what she has always wanted. She wanted to have a more independent life. So I think coming into Canada and seeing that this world allows women particularly to have much more independence and much more of a higher status within the community. They could have careers, they could go to school, they could have a job, they could have more equality within relationships and within society. And I think when she saw that and began to be part of that, I think it was very easy for her to adapt and assimilate that, because that is what she wanted for herself. So with my father and his position being more traditional, being more religious, obviously that tends to be more conformist. You know, you have to be a pillar of society, and you have to reflect the values and the customs of that particular religious background, and the rules and the expectations. So those two things, again, started out being diametrically opposed to each other when they were in India, and then that of course just became more accentuated when they came to Canada. Mm-hmm. Because now my mother did have a choice to sort of start pulling away from the cultural restraints, and she decided that that's not what was right for her anymore, and it was creating a lot of issues within the relationship. Absolutely.
Now, your mother was a musician, and you talk about your family, who everyone in your family seemed to really have an ability to play musical instruments, and this was something that was a very significant part of your family life, wasn't it?
It actually was, yes. We were, my father played Indian instruments. Tablas were what my brother specialized in, the oldest brother. My mother played sitar, and she played harmonium. She knew how to do dancing and singing. My older sister was also an accomplished dancer and singer. And the oldest brother did actually go on and become part of a band member for a band that was very popular in the 60s here, called the Poppy Family. And that was actually one of the first bands that sort of incorporated East-West music together, and they had some really big hits. They did really well, and my brother played many of the traditional Indian instruments in that. So it was a really kind of a great band within that sort of hippie movement. I think people really embraced that music. So yeah, that was a huge part, and also it was a religious part of the religion as well, because the family would sing hymns together in temples and that sort of thing, and in different ceremonies. It allowed us to do a lot of traveling and meeting a lot of people. So definitely music was always a huge part of our family and of our life, and it has remained so, you know, to this day.
Now, your dad taught you to read and write. He was very well educated, and he became very well known in his community for his writings and for the books he published. So the difference in temperaments and the aspirations of each one, your dad was happier being in more of a simplistic environment and life, and he was very, very intelligent. Your mother was extremely bright, but she wanted something different, and they ended up separating, and he went to India, back to India, and then you all were with your mother, and that involved a big challenge after a while, because she found being a single woman with children and trying to work, it was really a challenge. And then all of you ended up in India with your dad.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It was a bit of a taboo situation back in those days, because our families never, men and women didn't divorce. I mean, it just wasn't heard of, and particularly in a religious family. So that was quite a controversial kind of thing that happened with our family. And people sort of looked down upon, you know, how could this happen? This is not something that is supposed to be allowed. But that is what happened. They did end up, you know, the relationship was just not able to survive. And my father found it too difficult to stay here with the family fractured. He just decided that he was going to go to England. And that's where he went. And after a few years of my mother trying to be a single parent, as you point out, she decided that it would really be necessary for her to have some time where she was able to just be her own person for a while to sort of find her way. And so the kids, all of us, except for my oldest brother, we all were put on a plane and sent to England. So there we were living in England for just over a year. I was probably only about 15 years old at the time, probably 15, maybe most, at most, maybe 16.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so we went to England, lived there with my dad, and we had full-time jobs. We worked every day. And that was an interesting thing, being part of the working class, you know, getting in our subway, on the tube every morning and going to work in a sewing factory all day, earning money so that we could save money to move on to India for our travels. My father always thought it was important for us to go back to our home country to see what that was all about, and that it was important for us to know what our roots were. And that's part of why he wanted to teach us Punjabi, because we had lost the ability to really speak it, and also never read or wrote it. So every day after school when we were in Canada, he would give me and my other brother lessons, and I was grateful for it, because you know, it's never a waste to know other languages, but also it became our primary form of communication. When my father ended up, after our trip to India, he stayed there, and the kids, we eventually did come back after 2 years abroad.
Mm-hmm.
This is where all my amazing, you know, sort of eye-opening life experiences really got ingrained in me. And I think that, you know, those lessons that I learned really did change the trajectory that I was on. But it also gave me appreciations for things I never would have had I not had those 2 years abroad.
Mm-hmm. And what was so significant is that when you did go into India, you were so shocked by what you saw, because in Canada, you were a little girl when your mm-hmm. parents went to Canada, and you grew up in an environment where you had hot and cold running water, you had grocery stores, there were all kinds of things that were in your environment. When you got to India, it was really a shock. It was such a shock to you because of the poverty you saw, because of the, literally, the filth that you saw.
Yep.
And I don't know that that has changed very much in India from what I've heard from people that go over. In fact, lots of times people have a cultural shock because they have all kinds of ideas about what it should be. And mm-hmm. they've seen certain travel logs, and India is a fabulous mm-hmm. country. But it's not, it is very difficult. There's all these caste systems, and it's a lot of people are extraordinarily poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was also back in, you know, it's important to note that this would have been back in the early 70s that we were there traveling. So obviously India has made tremendous advances in all areas. In terms of its economic growth, education, they've become very high tech, you know, the medical field, computer, you know, tech people are all from India. And the standard of living has gone down, has gone up tremendously since we were there. But India is not just a country. It's like the whole planet all in one place,
because mm-hmm.
everything is, all the extremes are there. You have the richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor, and everything in between, and just the masses of people. And there was tremendous amount of poverty, and also just the inability of a country like that to meet the very, very, you know, extreme needs that people have. It was very poor infrastructure, especially back then, and, you know, India is pretty famous for the level of corruption that's always sort of existed in terms of, you know, the money not going back into the country and into building the infrastructures and building what's necessary there to provide, you know, for basic necessities. So if you're a handicapped person, you know, there were no supports. If you lived on the streets, you lived on the streets. There's no eligible, you know, benefits like you would get here as a citizen. It just simply didn't have the capacity to provide that. As a teenager, it was, as I say, not for the faint heart. For me, at that age, I did sort of, I used the term, it was like a tour of duty, you know, what I saw every day, what I was subjected to, it was just very overwhelming. And it is a good way to describe it. It is a culture shock, because there's nothing that resembles anything that you've seen, you know, during the time that I was here. It was just very overpowering, and the masses of people everywhere. So it really it just takes you aback, you know, because you think, oh, my God, especially for me, knowing that had I not come to Canada, that little kind of lottery, you know, the one in a million chance that we got to come here, if that hadn't happened, that is where I would have been raised and that is where I would have lived. And it was a shocker, you know, to me to think, well, this is what my life would have been like had I been raised here. I would have a very different standard of living. I would have very few choices at that time. You know, it was a very good chance that, you know, people were trying to get my sister married. There was lots of people coming to the house talking to my father during the time that we were in India saying, well, you know, this one here is about 20 years old. She should be getting married. And I was about, you know, 17 and this one should be engaged. So this is sort of where it really started hitting home that, you know, we have to find an exit strategy. Otherwise, we are going to be kind of forced, in a sense. We wouldn't have had really much choice to say no. And my father knew we didn't want to get married and settle down and live the traditional life. So the clock was ticking, in a sense, but it wasn't the biological clock. Mm-hmm. It was the freedom clock, and that was how are we going to leave here so that we can be in control of our own destiny and choose our own fate. And that is why, you know, we had to make a huge, huge effort to convince our father, who was going to stay in India, to let us come back to Canada so that we could pursue our own sort of education and our own independent lives.
You have beautiful photographs in here, and one of the photographs that is presented is the Golden Temple in Amritsar. And this I've seen videos on this temple, and it is amazing. And you were talking about in your book how 100,000 people a day were fed. Yes. And this is, I believe, a Sikh temple.
Uh-huh.
And
that's right.
The people come in, nobody's turned away. They don't care what your status is. If you're hungry, then sit down and have some food. And
exactly.
It's amazing.
Well, and I think that's very important for people to realize is that the Sikh faith was a rebellion against the caste system. The caste system is part of the Hindu faith. So they're based very much on you know, a hierarchy of social status. And in the Sikh faith, that is not part of the religion. It's very equality based. And that is what every temple does. It's called God's Kitchen, and everyone is welcome. You sit on, you know, it's very modest. Everyone sits together, whether it's on the floor or wherever, and they literally come with buckets, and they're just filling everyone's plates, and you can have as many as you want. And that's back in the early 70s, they were feeding about 100,000 people a day, and this is going on every single day. And in fact, not just in India, but anywhere there's a Sikh temple, people can go in and be fed. And no one tries to convince you to come in, and nobody tries to convert you and get you to, you know, recruit you or anything. If you want to make a donation, you can, but no one's going to tell you to come and join and become a Sikh or anything like that. It's simply God's Kitchen. And the Sikhs are known for being tremendously generous. They're very, very principled people, and they really believe in social justice and equality and food for all. So that is really something that's quite remarkable about the faith.
I would say so. And the temple is just gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful.
We got to see that every day, and it was just a stunning place. It really is. There's no other place like it. When you're there, you just really do feel the spirit of the place and just the beauty of it and the serenity, and just juxtaposed, you know, to the surrounding areas, which, you know, at that time anyway, looked like they didn't belong in the same, you know, city, because the Golden Temple was truly just like something that just looked like a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Even though around the surrounding areas may have been, areas that were not quite so well-to-do or pristine or anything. So it just shows the value that the community has in their places of worship. They really do take care of them. You're not allowed to go in with your shoes on, you have to have your head covered. And it's a whole process. It's not just you walk in off the street with your shoes and your whatever you were wearing, and you have to have a scarf, or the men have the turbans, and you don't wear shoes. You have to go in without your shoes on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very modest in every way. But it's all based on service. It's all volunteers that are working around the clock, you know, cutting vegetables, doing the cooking, doing the cleaning. All of it is done by a voluntary basis. And it is really something to see it.
It really is. And it's a phenomenal accomplishment when you think of it. And it's been there for quite a long time. Now, you went to college.
Yep.
And in college, you absolutely were like a sponge. You loved going to school. You really enjoyed all of this. And you finally found what you wanted to do. And in sharing your story about your family and the diversity of people from different parts of the world that you had exposure to, that all of this had a tremendous impact on your psyche. And so with the college education, you ended up being in different environments that actually helped you pull out of yourself the strength that you needed. You even were accepted by the Vancouver Police Department, and you had to fulfill certain physical requirements. And interestingly, you, being an immigrant, ended up being in a positioning of working with immigration. That ended up leading you into social work, which became your career for many, many years.
Very true. Yes. Yeah, I did. I went to college and I attended university as well. And then I worked at Canada Customs at the airport at Customs and Immigration. And wasn't quite the place where I felt that I was going to stay. And then I ended up before that, even before I went to customs, as you pointed out, I had an opportunity to try out for the Vancouver Police Department, and I did train very heavily for that. To pass the physical was not easy. It was very, very grueling. And I was very proud of that accomplishment. And at that time, they weren't really recruiting. So I was looking for a career still, that I hadn't sort of found my calling until I got into the whole area of social work, which was specializing in child protection and guardianship of children. And I did that for probably almost 30 years. And that ended up really, truly being my calling. And I think that because of my life experiences and just who I had become, I seemed to just have the what it was that was required to make a connection with these young people and to be a very strong advocate for them and do my absolute best to try to make their, you know, their lives as best as I could make them, you know, all things considered, that many of them had some very, very difficult histories and challenges. And it was a job that there was a lot of turnover. People did find stress very, very difficult. But I was very well suited for that work, and I'm really glad that I was able to do that and fulfill it. And I do believe that I was able to impact children in a very positive way. But, I mean, I also learned so much from them in terms of what resilience is all about and how many kids are, you know, put into horrible situations. And, you know, it's the luck of the draw if they happen to have the right caregivers, the right foster parents, and hopefully the right social worker. These things can come together, and they can make the best out of a very bad situation. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. You know, sometimes these things don't line up in the way that they should for the child, and their outcomes can be very bad, very poor. And as a result, they suffer, but society suffers as well when we don't invest in making children healthy and giving them the tools that they need to be, you know, healthy, functioning individuals in society.
Mm-hmm. And that is where you found your compass. That's where you found you were able to really get involved. And I know we're just about out of our time for our conversation. Living While Human, Arwinder Kaur, you have put so much in here that really shows that many times we'll travel a path, we'll go through experiences that awaken us to many realities that we would never have otherwise seen. And I think that in your travel journeys, in being in different environments in India, and in coming in contact with people of different belief systems, the diversity in your life that you have been able to experience, your social work has given you such a tremendous perspective overall with so many things, and you express your thoughts relative to that, and it really has enabled you to stay, what I would say, on purpose with what is so important to you, and that is communicating to others what you've learned and what you know. And that's what your book Living While Human is all about. And your website, people can go to your website. It's your name, and you have a very unique name, and it's Arwinder, Arwinder, and your last name is Kaur, Kaur, but your website is your name, arwinderkaurauthor.com, and people can find out more about you. And you have such an interesting drawing on the cover. It's like a pixel, but it has the Northwestern image. It looks like one of the totem faces.
Mm-hmm. On a it's totem. An indigenous mask. Yes.
Yes.
And the artist who actually did that painting is a friend of mine. His name is Polly Gartwa, and he was gracious enough to allow me to use his painting. And I do talk a lot about the indigenous culture. I know we're running out of time. And so I'd say the first half of the book is really about me becoming me and gaining my compass. And then the second half of the book really focuses much more about the planet and the plight of the planet and the sense of urgency about, you know, coming together, unifying for a global sort of response to what we're facing right now. So it's kind of, there is a lot there. I think you're right. It's hard to kind of encapsulate it all into such a short time. But I appreciate you taking the time out to talk about my book.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I think your book brings to issue how important it is for us to keep our minds and our attitudes open and to realize that each and every one of us have a special role to play, and we can fulfill that role in the ways that will be, well, what do I want to say, fulfilling to us as well as to others. Your father was a very good example of how to do that. Your mother was someone that had to discover her own path. And because of the two of them and everything that went in between, this, that, and the other, you came out with a whole different agenda yourself. And because of the freedoms that we have, then you were able to stay true to what you felt was right for you to be a part of. And I think that that is significant in reading your story. I want to thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you. It's really been wonderful, and I really appreciate you taking the time out to highlight my book and my experiences. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. It's been my pleasure. We are saying goodbye to Arwinda Kaur, and we are going to be taking a break. I am in studio, and if you'd like to give me a call, that phone number is 253-582-5597. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, day after tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and oh my goodness, the supermarkets are packed and people are just buzzing like crazy. And of course, after Thanksgiving, we've got the Black Friday, which is a traditional day where people, I think, sometimes goes bonkers just trying to get whatever it is that they want to get on special sale. And I want you to know, tomorrow evening, we're going to be talking with P.J. Caldas, and this is a gentleman from Brazil, and he has written a really intriguing book about artificial intelligence and a character called the Tigress. Oh, my goodness. It's just an amazing piece of writing that he actually wrote 8 years ago and just recently had it published. It's quite a read. It really, really is. Now, on Thanksgiving, I am going to be having a pre-recorded show that is going to be aired. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Sophia Dimas. And this is Consciousness Beyond Death. And we have a second author, Dr. Amy Stark. We're going to be discussing her just absolutely wonderful children's book. And this is what's going to be going on Friday. And then the last week of November, my goodness, these days just fly by. You're probably like me wondering if there was any pause button you could push. So we're going to have in the last week, we're going to be talking about Built for Freedom with Bob Gardner, Yesterday Never Sleeps with Jackie Heller, Sensory Processing Solutions, and a guest that is going to be rescheduled. We had scheduled a guest that was in England, and we're having a challenge with communication. I know they might be having weather challenges or whatever, but we'll be trying to get this guest that I had scheduled previously, Tobias Churton, so that we can have him. He's got a wonderful book on the history of alchemists. You know, they are chemists of ancient times, and his research is just fascinating. But I haven't been able to get information from him, so we are going to try to schedule him at another time. So we may have a surprise guest on the last day of November, and then, yes, we'll be starting in December. And, of course, that's the holiday season big time. The kickoff usually is Halloween, but, boy, it really goes into full mode of activity, action, parties, you name it. It's just going full bore right after Thanksgiving. And it's just an amazing cycle. I think one of the things that I enjoy about the holiday season is the beauty of what is around. I love the displays that are put up. I just think that there's so much creativity in the music and the engagement, the different performances and shows that are done. It's just, I don't know, there's just something so very, very special that occurs. And I thought, okay, that is something that is marvelous. And of course, everybody gets out their favorite recipes. Mm-hmm. They get out their favorite recipes, and we have to make sure that if we do indulge, which of course we're going to do, we are going to do those 5-mile marathons or something to make sure that we don't put on an extra 20 pounds. Oh, it's so easy. There's so much delicious stuff that people put together. They don't do it any other time during the year, typically. So Christmas time is, hey, we're pulling out all the stops. I wanted to share with you, by the way, the phone number, if you wanted to call in, is 253-582-5597. Don't ever underestimate people. You never know who is going to be available to assist you. And there is a gentleman by the name of Gregory, and he's a runner. And he has been really engaged in running on a regular basis since he turned 60. And he said sometimes he runs 15 miles or more a day. And he lives in Oregon near the Willamette River. And his home is actually in Eugene. Well, in Eugene, Oregon, I know because I used to travel there to do appearances, they have these wonderful, wonderful paths that you can ride a bike on or you can walk on, and the scenery is just breathtakingly beautiful. And he said, oh, there's just so much to see, and he always enjoys the runs because it helps him to deal with stress or whatever he's got going on. He just stays in excellent physical shape. But he was on this one run, and he said it was something I had never, ever experienced before and never thought I would experience. He was going up a particular bike path, and it was around the Willamette River. And he said he sees smoke. And it was about a quarter of a mile away from where he was at the moment when he was running. And he said they were coming out, the smoke, he got close to a fabulous place, the Valley River Inn. They've got the most beautiful view of the Willamette River. It's just an incredible place to be in. And he said, that's where you go if you want to have a really super dinner and have a beautiful view. He said, it's a great place, and I concur. And he said, when he's running, he always has a cell phone with him, and he doesn't video. He said, I'm not a person that's into doing videos. However, as he got closer to the Valley River Inn, and he was seeing the smoke, he said, I got out my phone because I wanted to get a video, and I was going to call 911. And then he hears the cries of someone asking for help. And there was a woman on a second floor balcony next to the room that was on fire, and she couldn't get out. She said, help, I need help. And he was very close to where she was, and he said, you need to get out of there. She said, I can't, the hallway is full of smoke. And he said, he started getting two words, and they were hit me, hit me. And he said he thought that maybe if she jumped, he could catch her. And he was saying this out loud. Now, just try to picture this. These words are coming out of his mouth. Hit me, hit me. He wanted to get across to her that she needed to jump towards him so he could catch her and break her fall. And she got the message. She figured it out. And he said the next thing he knew, she was in the air. She had jumped off the balcony, was coming straight at him. He ends up catching her, breaks her fall. And he said, it was really good. She was very petite. He said, neither of us got hurt. And they both got up. They got out of harm's way. And the video had been taken by someone of this situation. He wasn't taking the video. He was there. You know, it was all happening so quickly, but somebody got the video, and he said his son put the video of what happened on Instagram, and people were just responding like crazy. He said, I've got 15 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, and none of them knew that their grandpa could do this. He said, I'm of the old school. He said, if somebody's in trouble, you don't run away from it. And he said, I was in the Army in Vietnam. I'm a recovering alcoholic. He said, I've been sober for 33 years. And he said, there are days as you get older that you wonder if you still got what it takes to do something big. And he said, and then a moment like this comes along and you say, well, I guess I do. And there is a photo that I'm looking at of the fire that was coming out of this room. And the flames are licking. They are so high, and it's so hot that they are going up into the roof. And the fire department arrived not too long after that. This gentleman, when this occurred, can you guess his age? Well, I'll tell you. He's 75. Mm-hmm. So he is a very good example of how we can keep ourselves in shape, no matter what our age. And Jack LaLanne would definitely have said that. And Jack LaLanne, he passed away at 95, I believe it was. And he said, that's what you do. You keep yourself in good shape. But running 15 miles a day, I don't think I'd volunteer for that duty. Mm-mm. Not me. No, I'm the walker. I'm the speed walker. That's what I like to do. But anyway, I wanted to share that story with you because sometimes life calls upon us to do something and to be that right person to assist whoever needs the assistance. And that's exactly what he was able to do. And again, he didn't think that that was going to be something that would be a part of that day's experience. How many times did he run that trail? How many times has he just done what he's done and nothing's happened? You just never know. You have no idea what is going to make a difference just by your being the person you are. And at 75, he learned he was making a difference for that moment. And he's out there doing his runs every single day. Amazing. Donna Sebo here. 253-582-5597. Now, I have, as you know, if you listen to this show, I have a sweet tooth. Mm-hmm. And I have a recipe here for cream cheese cookies. There's nothing like cookies that, they're just wonderful. They make great gifts. And you can use your imagination as to how you want to package them as a gift. And I think there are so many people that we would just like to remember, people of all ages. It's wonderful to be creative and to put things together. You don't have to spend a fortune in gifts. And sometimes, one of the memories that I cherish are the conversations that I've had with people through the years when it came to the holidays. And I think of one woman that I worked with. She was Norwegian. And in her family, when she was growing up, and even as an adult, she was very much, she had a very nice family. It was a good size. And relatives would come in, and she said, what we do every year, we pick a house, and we go to that house, and this is for the women especially. And she said, starting in, I think it was October, they would start making their cookies and everything for Christmas, because they had very special church services and other activities as a family that they had done traditionally for years. And she said, we women would get together and we would form an assembly line and we would make our cookies. And some of the cookies you could make sort of at the last minute, but these were cookies and cakes that needed to be stored so that the flavors would mellow. And it was really a big tradition with her family to do this, and the women just absolutely enjoyed it. And they would talk, and they would munch and crunch whatever they had fixed to make sure that everything turned out just right, of course. And this was just something, I recall her talking about it and how much it meant, and they would involve the children many times to teach them to do this on their own. You know, it's like passing along certain traditions of baking and just the stories of family members, etc. And this was very, very special. And it kept that family unity together in a very, very special way. Well, I think that's what the magic of cookies do. I think that, or does. I really think that when you have a homemade item that you share with people, it makes all the difference in the world. It really, really does. And this cream cheese cookie recipe is so simple, but it has so much flavor. And they won't last very long, believe me. And what you're going to need, 8 ounces of cream cheese, and that needs to be at room temperature. You need 1/2 cup of unsalted butter, room temperature. All ingredients need to be at room temperature. 3/4 cup of sugar, 1 to 2 tablespoons of finely grated orange peel. And that is magical, the orange peel, because of the oils in the orange peel. I'd say 2 tablespoons. I like a stronger flavor, but that would be your choice. 1 to 2 tablespoons of finely grated orange peel. 1 teaspoon of vanilla, 1 1/2 cups of all-purpose flour, 2 teaspoons of baking powder. You're going to need just a pinch of salt and 1/2 cup of chopped pecans and powdered sugar. So just have everything out, everything in order. And what you do, you're going to use your electric mixer, of course, and you're going to cream the cheese, the cream cheese, and the butter. You have that in your big bowl, and you cream it at a high speed until both ingredients are very light and fluffy. And then gradually you breathe in the sugar and then blend in your grated orange peel and the vanilla. Then your flour, while the machine is doing the work, you can sift your flour, your baking powder, and that little pinch of salt. You don't need a lot, just a pinch. And you gradually add that to your cheese mixture. And of course, you're going to have that going at low speed. And then once everything is combined, you stir in your pecans. And you just take all of the dough, you make a ball of the dough, and then wrap it in wax paper or plastic, your saran wrap, whatever, and then you put it in the refrigerator and let it chill for 30 minutes or longer. And when you're ready to bake, you're going to put your rack in the upper third of the oven. That oven needs to be preheated to 400 degrees, hot, yes. You're going to need 2 baking sheets. I like to use parchment paper, but if you like, you can just have the regular baking sheet and just put a little bit of nonstick cooking spray on it. And you're going to pinch off small walnut-sized pieces of dough, roll them into balls, and put them on the prepared baking sheets. And you dip your fork into the powdered sugar and press into each cookie twice to form a crosshatch design. And you're going to flatten that cookie that you're making to 1/4 to 3/8 inch thickness. And you're going to bake those cookies until they're just lightly browned and starting to set around the edges. Now, it's going to be about 7 to 8 minutes. And the centers of the cookie are going to be soft. Then you transfer to racks and let them cool completely before you would even serve them. But this makes about 5 dozen cookies. And if you wanted, you could add sugar sprinkles in there of color. There's so many different things that you could do with this. And if you like lemon, you could use freshly grated lemon peel. That is something that is an option. Maybe even make a lemon lime. Again, your imagination. But if you try this just as it is, these are melt-in-your-mouth cookies. And they really, really keep very, very well. So I thought I would share that with you because so often we might have a chance to go to a nursing home or we've got a bazaar. And when we're able to make cookies like this and share them with people, or even if you want to have a cookie sale, this isn't something that most people are going to find that they have in the local grocery store. And there's just that, I don't know, it's sort of like a chef's magic. When you prepare something and you really enjoy what you're doing, it's as if that energy goes right into the food that you prepare. And there is just this wonderful, wonderful feeling of satisfaction and appreciation for the time and effort and I would say the love that goes in to fixing those cookies, and they transport beautifully. And if you have anybody in the military, you know, fixing up boxes of cookies and making sure you pack them right so that they are going to survive the trip, the people overseas, the military, they really appreciate it. They really do. They thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy it. Donna Sebo here. Quickly, I thought I would share something with you that crossed my desk. And there are so many items anymore that are made of materials that we think should be recyclable, but they're not. And I've talked with a number of people, and they, like me, get very frustrated. They say, why can't we put the plastic, just put any plastic in? Well, there was a person that said there is an association of plastic recyclers, and they say not to put tough to sort plastic forks, knives, and spoons into curbside recycling. And if you are a person that orders food in, ask the restaurant not to give you those items. I have to tell you that I had a business meeting at Microsoft, and this was a number of years ago. Everything that they had, utensils included, were not in their coffee room that they had. They were made out of potatoes, so they could be recycled right along with paper items. And they had bins for recycling. And I was astonished. Those utensils were extraordinarily strong, but they were biodegradable. Just fascinating. That was years ago. So I wonder, why can't we do more of that? But that's just my observation. Also, don't put plastic bags, the thin plastic bags, those from bread, produce, resealable storage bags, and shipping pillows into any curbside recycling. They said, don't do that because it jams up the equipment that they have at this time. They said, find a retailer that has bins specifically for plastic bag recycling. And you can go to earth911.com and find out about it. And those cold packs that we put in the freezer so that we can keep items nice and cold when we transport them. Well, they should be placed, if you're going to throw it out, in regular trash. What they have is a liquid inside of them, and it may not be something that should go into any kind of recycling, and you should just put it in the regular trash where it's contained, and there are some of those cold packs that actually can be non-toxic. The ingredient on the inside is drain-safe gel, which you can pour down the sink. It won't be a negative. Plastic containers, clean them. And it depends on your recycling rules. And reusable bags, those thick plastic bags that we can get, they feel like cloth or look like cloth. You can't recycle those. donate them to a local food bank if that's what you want to do. Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. My goodness. It's gobble, gobble, gobble pretty soon. I'll talk with you tomorrow evening. Bye for now.
Been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.